Yhteistyössä mukana Design Museo ja Camp Garden.
Debbie Millman is an American writer, educator and designer of the Burger King logo and packaging for Tropicana, and of course the host of the podcast Design Matters. Design Matters is the world's first podcast about design and an inquiry into the broader world of creative culture through wide-ranging conversations with creatives.
This is Helsinki Design Weekly, and we are Ida Kukkapura
and Anni Korkman,
and this time we do it in English. And every week we discuss design live and in podcasts. At Weekly we look at the world through design lenses, since everywhere we go and everything we do has been designed. The power that design has on us makes it clear that it cannot be ignored but discussed. Welcome to Helsinki Design Weekly, Debbie Millman. It's great to have you here.
Oh, thank you so much. It's wonderful to be here as well.
Before we'll surely find out how you became who you are now, a podcast host, a keynote speaker of the Huiput Creative Festival here in Helsinki, a design world powerhouse in general, and the fiancé of the author Roxane Gay as well. Congratulations.
Thank you.
Let's start with a question that you often ask your guests on the podcast. What did you want to become when you were a kid?
Oh, well, when I was a kid, I just wanted to survive. It was, I had a rather challenging upbringing, but I always loved to make things. I made perfume from baby oil and rose petals and talcum powder, which ended up kind of being more like glue than perfume. I used to make little shows with my brother. I made a magazine with a friend that lived in my neighborhood. Her name was Debbie also, and so we titled it very cleverly Debutante, which I still think is a really, really good
love that.
Name for a magazine, although I was just in South Africa and they have a pizza chain called Debonair, and I thought that was really nice too. I was like, that would have been a good name for the magazine. But I didn't really have a sense of what I could be, but I did always have this sense of wanting to be creative.
Since this is a design program and we aim to only discuss any matters design, understanding the vast scale of all this, how did you first levitate towards the trade of design?
Well, it was quite by accident. I ended up working in college for the student newspaper. I thought at that point that maybe I would do something with journalism. I had a degree. I was getting a degree in English literature, which is something that you can't really do very much with unless you go on and get a PhD, and I wasn't interested in doing that. And so I started working for the student newspaper and became the editor of the arts and features section, which then, unbeknownst to me at the time, required that I also put the paper together. And back then it was very old school drafting table layout and paste up kind of skill requirements. And so I found quite by accident that I loved to do that as much, if not more, than edit the paper. And so when I graduated, my only real skill set was old school layout and paste up. And I ended up getting a job at a magazine, and a design career was inadvertently born.
You make that sound so effortless. First,
oh, God, no. Yeah, it wasn't effortless at all.
Studying English and ending up in branding, for example. And yet your talk here in Helsinki in the Huiput Festival is about rejection. Would you say your career path was or was not easy?
Oh, it hasn't really been easy up until very, very recently.
Right.
It was... As Brené Brown would put it, a slugfest, a street fight. I was constantly trying to prove that I could do more than people ever thought I could, and often was really challenged by in trying to do things. So, yes, I have a career of what I would consider to be a combination of rejection, perseverance, and success.
Nice combo, and nice that it's getting kind of, it sounds like it's kind of, it has been getting better. And you did talk, or you have been talking about this 10-year plan of a remarkable life in one of your interviews. And it's something, an affirmation exercise that you wrote back into the School of Visual Arts. When did you write it and what was in it? Because you've said that it kind of came to be as you imagined your future?
Well, back in 2005, I took a class with Milton Glaser. And he at the time was teaching a summer intensive at the School of Visual Arts. And this was before I started teaching there. And the class was for mid-level designers that were looking to sort of reboot their creativity. And I took the class. And as part of the classwork at the very end of the program, the class culminated in writing what Milton had described as a 5-year plan. And it was an exercise to envision your life 5 years into the future, where you had one day doing everything that you ever hoped you could, and to imagine what that would be like. And it was an exercise about living with abundance as opposed to scarcity. It was about imagining yourself doing things that you might otherwise be afraid of allowing yourself to imagine. And he asked us to write it all down from the minute we wake up until the minute we go to sleep, every single detail, our house, our spouse, our pets, our bed sheets, our car, bicycle, job, hobbies, everything that we wanted to include in a possible life 5 years from then. And because it was Milton, and because he talked about this particular exercise having quite a lot of power, I put a lot of energy into it. I wrote my heart out into this essay. I not only wrote the essay, I also wrote a list of the things that were included in the essay. I was really trying to be an overachiever in this exercise. And he asked us to really imagine immensities because he found that this exercise was quite magical, and that very, very often he heard from students that had taken the class, and 5 years after their essay was written, they had manifested this really remarkable life. And so I did that. And after a year or so, I started to see various things manifesting that I had put on the list. The list was what I considered to be big, grand, ambitious possibilities. And by the end of the 5 years, I would say that 70% had come true. And then over the next 5 years, almost everything. And I still can't believe it. I still can't believe that that happened. And then one of the things on my list was teaching as well, and teaching at the School of Visual Arts. And then I started teaching at the School of Visual Arts. And it wasn't through Milton, so it wasn't like he helped me get the opportunity. And then I decided as part of the coursework that I was teaching at that point, it was several years later, Milton had stopped teaching his class after 40 or 50 years of teaching this. And he did say that it was one of the most important things that he had done in his career. I asked him if it would be okay to take that exercise and use it in my classwork, but I wanted to change it because the students that I was teaching were much younger than I was when I took his class. And I thought 5 years wasn't enough time. Also, it took me more like 13 years to manifest almost all of it. The only things that really didn't happen were things that I chose not to pursue. And so now I teach it as a 10-year plan for a remarkable life. That's what I've called it.
And what else was on the list than teaching also at the School of Visual Arts in New York?
Teaching at the School of Visual Arts, writing a book of visual essays and poetry, which I did, writing a book of interviews like Design Matters, which I did, being part of the American Institute of Graphic Arts, which I not only did, but ended up becoming president of, continuing my radio show. Yeah, I mean, it was really quite astonishing. Doing exhibits, curating, I'm doing that as well. So literally every single thing on there.
Dreaming can be so powerful.
It really can. So then I decided, and a lot of people have asked me over the years, well, did you write another one? And I hadn't. And I decided in 2017 that I was going to write another one. And by December 31st, I hadn't written it yet. And so I didn't go out on New Year's Eve. I stayed home, and that was because it was my deadline to write the next one. And I did. And now it's two plus years later. And some of those things have manifested as well, which is crazy, crazy.
It sounds like such an empowering thought to be able to literally write your own future.
Well, I think there's something about admitting what you want. Mm. And then I think that the writing is a declaration of sorts where you're actually manifesting it tangibly in a place that lives on. And I think that declaration is a big part of it. I think a lot of us imagine possibilities, but actually declaring those possibilities and envisioning those possibilities, I think is very powerful.
So if our listeners are interested in doing it, it's worth Googling your 10-year plan to find out more about this exercise.
Well, interestingly, someone that heard me speaking about this on the Tim Ferriss Show, which is where I spoke about it publicly and where it's gotten a lot of traction, decided to create a website. And I believe it's called your10yearplan.com.
It is called that.
and he talks about how I got the idea from Milton. And then he transcribed the way I described it on Tim's show for anybody that wants to follow the specific directions. Oh, wow. And so it's all that out there for you to find.
Nice. Well done, kind of.
I know.
Weird, but nice.
I would like to discuss some of our dreams at Helsinki Design Week. So we are this media Helsinki Design Weekly, and we always also do a festival here in Helsinki in September, and we always choose a theme. And the theme for this year is Commitment Matters. And I now realize that it actually sounds like a reference to your show.
Oh, that's okay.
Consciously, it wasn't.
I'm cool with that.
But now it sort of makes sense, which I only realize now when I said it. But anyway, this as two words is meant to be used as a tool for all these hundreds of makers that make the festival with us, and sort of work for all of us to be used to think and arrange our thoughts into what are we committed to, and what is the value, and what is the meaning, and what is it that we want to say with our work. And this is what I would now like to ask you, Debbie Millman, in your profession, what are you committed to achieving?
Well, I'm committed to, through Design Matters, sharing the stories of designers and really incredibly creative people, to share the arc of their lives, to understand how they can design their own lives, but also how they navigate through insecurity and obstacles and their own fears. That's very important to me. I feel that those stories help other people overcome their own insecurities. And I find that other than maybe Milton Glaser or Massimo Vignelli, they're the only two people I've ever interviewed that really just seemed completely cool with who they are without doubting themselves. But I interviewed them both when they were in their 80s. So I think that by then you kind of earn it. Yeah. So that's one of the things that I feel I'd like to be able to contribute publicly. Personally, I've been on my own journey to try to find meaning and purpose in my own life and feel that I'm contributing something valuable or meaningful. So I think those are the two things that probably mean more to me than anything.
This is interesting that you're speaking about the meaning, since this is something that I kind of have been, while listening to your show, and what you're looking for is exactly makes sense. And I just want to point out that you said in the last episode, which was an interesting one, because you were in your own show interviewed by someone else. and Roxane Gay was interviewing you in Design Matters in the last one, where she asked this clever question, because nowadays Design Matters, a podcast for 15 years, has been kind of not only covering designers or design issues, but creatives and other professionals as well. So the name of the show, Design Matters, is maybe, it's not too narrow, but I mean, it's narrow. Does it represent the show anymore? But you answered to her that if you would change the name, you had a very good answer that you can maybe tell your tell it yourself, and maybe this also answers the question of why you're looking for the meaning.
Right. Well, the other possibility that came to me at one point several years ago was the name What Matters, because that's what I'm trying to uncover. Well, I don't know. What do you think about that as two design experts? What do you think about changing the name to that?
I really like it.
Yeah. Yeah, it makes you think.
Yeah. So we'll see. We'll see.
Maybe. Did we just rebrand your show?
We might have. All points back to this day in Helsinki.
You're welcome.
More branding after the pause at Helsinki Design Weekly.
Yhteistyössä mukana Design Museo ja Camp Garden.
This is Helsinki Design Weekly, where Ida and Anni, and with us today is Debbie Millman. Design Matters, the podcast, has about 5 million downloads a year, correct?
I think it's a bit more now, but okay. I'm not sure. Who's counting? Who's counting?
It's more than 5 million downloads a year. That's a lot, anyway. It is one of the earliest podcasts in general, and probably the first design podcast. When you first started on doing the interviews, When you first started doing the interviews on the phone, the line didn't sound too good. I mean,
it sounded terrible. Let's be honest. Let's call a spade a spade. It was horrendous.
You're trying to be
it
so.
It was unlistenable. No. It was unlistenable.
Okay, let's not go to the archives. But what did you know about interviewing when you first started?
Nothing. Oh, okay. I knew nothing. It was a learned process over time. I really wasn't intending at the time to do something that would end up defining my life. This was a little online radio network that had started to take advantage of the internet. And I was approached in 2004. This was before the iPhone even came out. And I was invited to what I thought was going to be a paid position. I was asked to create a radio show for Voice America, the business network. And at the time, I'll talk about this during my talk for Huiput, I was doing really well in branding. And it was really the first time in my professional career that success was tangible, that I felt that what I was doing, I was doing well. And because of that, I had essentially abandoned everything else that I was doing to experience that success as much as possible. I abandoned all of the other creative work that I was doing and just completely and totally immersed myself into the world of branding. And about 8 or 9 years in, I started to feel like my creative soul had all but disappeared and that everything I was doing was commercial. And then one day I got this little phone call, this cold call, and this lovely man was offering me an opportunity to do this little radio show. And I actually thought he was offering me a job, but he wasn't. He was offering me an opportunity to pay them to produce a show. This will probably give you an indication of the level of desperation I was feeling in my own creative life, because I thought, oh, this could be a creative thing and maybe somehow I could bridge it with my professional business and interview other clients or brand consultants, but also interview designers and creative people. And so that's how it started. And so I did. I had to pay them. And again, if you listen to those early shows, I think they sort of rival what the professionality of a show like Wayne's World might have had at the time. I often felt like Wayne and Garth were producing my show. I swear that the producers were doing bong hits when I was on commercial break. They were in Arizona. I was in New York. It was all done remotely.
But did you always call the guests? Is that how it
was?
Yes,
it was two handsets.
So it was on a phone line.
Two phone lines. And sometimes they were sitting in front of me and sometimes they would come in remotely. But if they were sitting across from me, I don't know if you've ever experienced having let's say, a family conversation on your home telephones, landlines, when you were little. And so, like, you were talking to grandma, and then you'd pick up in the kitchen, and they'd pick up, and your parents would pick up somewhere else, and you'd have that echo. Well, that was what it was like 100% fantastic. Of the time. So I got really good at listening at what line to listen to, because there was always an echo. And then after 100 episodes, I was approached by the late, great Bill Drentel, one of the founders of Design Observer, one of the first design blogs. And he asked me if I'd bring the show to Design Observer with the proviso that I change and improve the sound quality. And that's when he introduced me to Curtis Fox, because I didn't know how to do it. I didn't know how to improve the sound quality. I'm not an engineer. And so he introduced me to Curtis Fox in 2009, and he's still my producer, and we've now produced together over 400 shows, I think, or over 300 something shows. Yeah,
we're so lucky to be in the studio of Radio Helsinki with the really good sound quality.
Yeah, this is amazing what you have here, listeners. It's really swanky.
It looks different to you, where you started from, I guess.
Yes.
In total, you've interviewed like 500 creatives so far.
Well, I did the 100 with Voice America, and then I've done another over 300, probably 350 or so.
So you met so many different people from
yes.
different kind of even branches. Is it possible to summarize what are kind of the most important takeaways that you've learned of just talking with people and actually having the hour or so with them and talking about things?
Well, there are a couple of things. Certainly curiosity, a real ability to imagine. As I mentioned before, perseverance, because there's very few people that I've spoken to that have just had perfect lives and everything they touched was successful. A sense of empathy in imagining others and visioning what the world could be for others. Courage that your ideas matter and that you can make a difference with those ideas. I think those are some of the things that I've learned.
That's quite a nice degree to take, if you can say so. How do you decide who you invite? What are the channels you follow, or how do you choose your relevant guests? Are they doing something topical that you then kind of want to discuss with them, or are they just from pure curiosity of your personal
99% of the people I interview are people that I'm interested in talking to. So I do all my own booking and reach out to people that I'm interested in. And then that other 1% are people that come to me that I'm excited by and then agree to do the show with. And that's often people that I wouldn't have approached because I didn't think they'd be interested. So one of the best examples is Thomas Kail, who directed the Broadway musical Hamilton. And I got wind from his people. They reached out to me and said that Tommy wanted to be on the show. And I thought I was having a practical joke played on me. But no, he came on. And that was really one of my best shows. I think he is a remarkable creative genius. And so to have that opportunity. So every now and then things like that happen, which are remarkable good luck.
Is there someone you would never take into your studio?
I wouldn't take people into the studio that I don't respect. Mm. People that are that I'm very politically opposed to. Anybody that's cruel. Mm. Anybody that treats people, children, or animals poorly.
And who is your guest of dreams?
Michelle Obama.
Good answer.
So she hasn't yet been on?
No, she hasn't. I've met her.
She hasn't been here either.
I've met her when I was very, very lucky and I got a Cooper Hewitt National Design Award for the show.
Oh, wow.
And that allowed me to go to the White House for a reception. And I did meet her and took an official portrait with her. I can tell you that she is very tall. Even in my heels, she was a good foot higher. But she also smells very good. And she's even more beautiful in person, if wow. that's possible.
Wow. I can imagine, kind of.
Yeah.
It was a bit magical, but
It was a really, it was one of the highlights of my life. But no, I have not interviewed her, not at least not yet.
Not yet.
I think as an author, she's kind of a good guest as well to be on your show.
Absolutely.
You can frame it like that.
Okay.
You do also live shows. You talk on stages, on big stages, on in front of big audiences. But you've said that the podcast studio is your happy place. What's the magic in working only with sound? What is it that you like about that?
Well, the nice thing about working in the studio and doing shows the way that I do them is that there is a real intimacy that can be created. And I feel like that's palpable. My studio is very small. I like it that way. My producer is in the studio with us, but he sits behind the guests so they aren't distracted. And we're sitting maybe 3 feet apart. We're looking directly at each other. It's a little bit dark because it's a sound studio and the walls are black. And I think that there's a certain rapport that can be developed. And there's something about looking in someone's eyes and speaking very, very respectfully about that person is a way to engage with them in a, I think, open to possibilities kind of way, if that makes sense. And because I do such deep research on the people that I speak to, I think there is a sense that I really respect who they are. And also because I do my own booking and they know that I am specifically interviewing them for them, then I think that it allows for a certain kind of engagement that I wouldn't otherwise have. And I don't get on stage, which is very different. I like doing shows live, and I do more and more and more now at festivals and conferences and so forth, but my preference is direct one-on-one. I now often say no to people that only want to do it remote studio to studio because I just don't think you get the same intimacy.
I totally understand kind of what you're saying, but this is something that it's a bit of a disclaimer, but I read that you really, as you said, you do a deep research and you collect kind of material of your guests, like from 40 to 50 pages of research. And it's a disclaimer that we did not write 50 pages or collect 50 pages of material of you while we've been listening to you. So
that's totally okay.
I think
you're doing really well.
Thank you. But when I read about your sort of how you prepare for the show, I was really amazed. And that's a dream for me to be able to really actually, you know, read a lot and to really kind of dive into the topic each time. But you do a lot of things. So how is this possible? Like, how do you have a big team doing stuff, or how do you have time for?
I just manage my time really well. I don't know. I don't really have an answer for that other than, I mean, I used to say, well, I'm not married and I don't have any children, so I have a very elastic life. I'm going to be getting married, so I can't say that quite the same way anymore.
So but maybe only 30 pages in the future.
But I don't find it laborious. The work that I do is, I get a lot of joy from, and my research is one of the great joys because I can go into a zone where 3 or 4 hours will go by and I don't even know that that's happened. And it's spooky the way it happens. I'll look at the time, I'll go deep into my research, I'll look at the time again, 3 hours, 4 hours have passed, and I'm like, what just happened? How did that happen? I didn't move, I didn't get up, I didn't drink, I didn't go to the bathroom, I just was in this sort of zone. But I enjoy that.
No Pomodoro technique there.
Yeah.
Is Design Matters your day job?
No. I have a job at the School of Visual Arts where I run a graduate program in branding. And I've been doing that for the last 10 years. But also while I was doing that, I also, up until 2016, was the head of a branding consultancy. And I did that for 20 years. So yeah, this was a side project, a side hustle, as they call it now. It was a Hail Mary to recapture some of my creative spirit, and I've been doing it ever since.
It's really impressive.
I remember a couple of years ago, you had Alice Rawsthorne as your guest.
Yes.
In your show. It's a great episode. And she said in the episode that you cannot disengage from design since every single day we interact with it.
Yes.
And this is something that is very much the ethos of Helsinki Design Weekly as well, since the quality of design always affects us, our well-being, confidence, empowerment and our lives in general. Do you think people in general ignore design?
I don't think they ignore design.
Yeah. Why do you think is important that we
discuss?
I think
they might take it for granted. Yeah. They might. I don't think that anybody can ignore how a door opens or how stairs work or don't work or how something feels in their hands or in their body or on their body. I think that we don't think about that necessarily as much as designers might, which is probably fine because they don't have to. They can think about other things. But I do think that the condition of design reflects the condition of our culture, as does branding. And I think that design informs and impacts every single thing we do every single day.
Absolutely. And you've just arrived to Helsinki. So has there been something in your experience here that has been designed particularly well that you've paid attention to?
No. It's a little bit hard to say because I have not even been here for 24 hours.
Okay.
What
and
I can
it's a
tell
blizzard.
You, what I can tell you, and I'm actually really curious to discuss this with you, is why are the blankets so small?
The blankets, as in beds, the blankets.
Yes, the duvets. They're not that big. So I have a nice king size bed in my room. And then there are two blankets folded in half on either side. But they I can't cuddle up with them.
Oh,
they're small blankets.
This is not greeting to the hotel. This is very...
But I've noticed this quite a lot in the Scandinavian countries. But this is something I've experienced
many
times.
But you're American. You have everything is big in America.
In America.
Yes. Yes.
Even the duvets.
Even the duvets.
Absolutely. But you know what? We find out. That's our specialty. We kind of...
It's a challenge now accepted. We are going to find out. For Debbie.
And we'll test a big blanket. What we do often also actually, in our episodes, we test stuff.
Yeah,
so
this
we
is
test
a way
design.
This, yes, because I've also, in Germany, they were even smaller.
No.
This one is actually, I mean, it was like a coffin blanket. It was a blanket that was this the wide as a coffin. I had to like lay as flat as possible and I couldn't move my arms or curl up or anything. It was just this small little blanket. So Germany and now Finland, and I've experienced this now many, many times in Europe. The blankets are smaller.
We'll definitely test this. And yeah, this we kind of find ourselves as kind of the design detectives.
Yeah.
We often try to point out small things. This is a great tip. Thank you very much. We'll definitely test a big blanket. Does it make a difference? Because we, in Finland,
and also when two people are sleeping together. So if I had been sleeping with, if Roxanne had come and we were there in bed together. So the two blankets also, because I'm a very active sleeper. I wake up and my hair looks like it's standing straight up because I'm so active while I'm sleeping. The pillows were amazing. The pillows here are amazing. Amazing.
Thank you, pillows.
But so the blanket, so what I did was I unfolded both of them and then put like one half and then a third was overlapping like a Venn diagram. My blankets were a Venn diagram, but I'm tossing and turning, but then I woke up in the middle of the night and they were on either side of me and I was with no blanket. And then I also need to also say that because my luggage was lost, I was sleeping in my clothes.
That sounds like the worst night in Helsinki.
We'll try to get you a bigger blanket for next time.
Thank you.
This was not the question that we would have assumed worked like this, that it would make us laugh like this. But you often try to ask a question that would surprise your guests or that would kind of break the ice in the beginning of the show.
Yes.
Have you ever asked something that would make people like angry or that they would be saying afterwards that they don't want this to be published? Have you ever managed to sort of poke that feeling in people?
Not at the beginning.
Or
not
is
at
this
the beginning.
More often... that people just laugh like this?
People laugh. I find that it doing that sort of breaks the ice. it gives people the understanding that I have done my research and that I respect them enough to learn as much as I possibly can. The most contentious episode I ever had was with Richard Saul Wurman, and he is the founder of TED, the TED conference, and he didn't like my questions. First of all, I don't think he had ever listened to the show, so he didn't understand that my interviews are a deep dive into a person's life. And so we started talking, and I asked him about his early life and his father and his family and so forth. And then I got to a part where I was asking him about a particularly difficult time in his life. He was homeless. He was living in what he referred to in my research that I found, a flop house. And I asked him about that, thinking, well, wow, this is one of the most successful people I've ever interviewed. He's world renowned. He's created this remarkable conference that he went on to sell, and he's written all these books, and thought that my listeners would be super interested in understanding how does, and he was 40 when this happened, when he was living in this, so to speak, flop house. So I started to ask him about it. He's like, why are we talking about this? I'm like, well, I think it's really interesting to see how you managed to overcome this adversity and then create this remarkable life. He's like, well, I have no interest in talking about the past. I'm like, okay, so sorry. And then I tried to recover with other things. And then at one point he's like, these questions are terrible. And I was like, okay, well, what kind of question do you want? He's like, that's a good question. I was like, okay. And he's like, do you think I'm an asshole? And I just stared at him, and he's like, okay, then.
Is that live? Or, I mean,
it's all there. And then he was just so disrespectful and kind of brutal with me that at one point I just said, forget it. I'm not in my head. I can't do this anymore. So I quickly wrapped up and wanted to finish the show. And then he said, oh, well, can I get a do-over? And I said, well, if we play by my rules. And then we tried for another 20 minutes, and we could never, ever get in sync. And I've gotten more correspondence about that show than any other show I've done, except for the Tim Ferriss show.
So, I can imagine.
And the show that I did that I get the correspondence from is actually the show that Tim did with me, not the show that I did with him.
Yhteistyössä mukana Design Museo ja Camp Garden.
This is Helsinki Design Weekly, and Ida and Anni, we are talking with Debbie Millman. You came up with the jingle even to your dogs, which is a funny little story I wrote somewhere in a random interview about dogs.
I just make up songs a lot.
And I think it's a good kind of bridge to the topic of branding, because you branded taking a dog on a walk so well that the dogs now know the word
walkie. Milwaukee, and then Wisconsin. But you have to know the
okay, so just explain.
So if I would say walkie, both my dogs unfortunately are back. They're in heaven now. Well, hopefully, fortunately for them.
On a long walk, hopefully.
Yeah, on a very nice walk. back in the day, I'd say, who wants to go for a walkie? And grab the leash, and they'd both get really excited and jumping up and down. And so if I would mention to my partner, then partner at the time, should we take them for, even if I whispered walkie, they'd hear it, because, you know, dogs have great hearing. So they'd perk up and run. And so then I changed it to saying, should we take them to Milwaukee, which is a city in Wisconsin? And then they figured that out. And so I switched it to, all right, well, should we take them to Wisconsin? Because Milwaukee is in Wisconsin, and that would be the code word for, should we take them for a walk?
And your dogs didn't know that.
And they did not figure out the Wisconsin part.
But this is a great example of how simple branding can be.
Yes.
And branding also seems to include all of these major fields of interest of yours, like storytelling and creativity and design. What do you see being the greatest influence branding has on our lives?
Well, it's a long history. We can go back to the first markings that we created on the cave walls of Lascaux, which we used symbols to record our experiences. And that's something that we started to do 32,000 years ago. And that has evolved over time to include the way that we telegraphically express our beliefs. And the first marks that we created were religious symbols. So we did that as a way to indicate our beliefs telegraphically. We felt safer and more secure in groups. And so that recognition allowed us to feel like we were seen and safe. And that has evolved continually over the last 6,000 years. About 160 years ago, with the advent of the Trademarks Registration Act, we then created a way for brands to be legally recognized. And so our first brands were symbols that indicated consistency, quality. We at the time, consumers were very willing to pay a premium for something that was in a box or in a wrapper or a canister. What's interesting now is that we're now willing to pay a premium for things that aren't in a box or a container or a canister. We are very interested in things that are organic. Back then, we worried about the safety and the consistency and the quality and so forth. But I'm really excited about the way that people, not corporations, are beginning to use the same tenets of branding to communicate the view that they want to have about the world. So this really began with the Arab Spring, where we were beginning to use technology to communicate our ideas, to create more consensus that then created change. And then we saw that happen with Occupy Wall Street in the United States. We see that with Black Lives Matter. We see that with Me Too. We now see that with Extinction Rebellion, which has a logo and has a website and a slogan. And so movements are using the corporate tenets of branding to create change and a vision for the way we want to see the world. So we started with what I consider to be very bottom-up branding, which were religious symbols that were created to honor a higher power and connect us in that connection, in that creation. And then we started to create more what I would call top-down brands, with corporations owning that distribution and profit. And now back to creating bottom-up brands where humans, people, non-corporate people, are creating movements and a roadmap for growth and change that we haven't seen since the creation of those marks 6,000 years ago. So I'm excited about what we can do with branding now.
And obviously this relates to the idea of a personal brand as well. We all,
yes and
during
no.
these times, we build these brands about our personalities, and we want to show our beliefs through the certain ideas and systems.
Well, those are attributes that we would like to include in who we are. But I have real issues with personal branding, because brands are fixed entities, and brands are supposed to be consistent and reliable, and they are manufactured. And humans aren't manufactured. Humans are messy. We make mistakes. We grow. We recover. We evolve. Those are all things that brands tend not to want to do so much. And I think if we want to be seen as brands, then we are asking for a manufactured way of creating a persona. Whereas I think it's more important to build a reputation, and that allows for change and growth. And so I'm still working out what it means to want to be a brand, but right now I'd rather be a person.
That's just a good way to put it, and also super interesting, because obviously you own the Design Matters brand, for example, and then someone would say that Debbie Millman is a sort of brand. But do you consider that? Even these days, because this is something that I think is talked about a lot, like how do you present yourself in the social media and how you use your name and what kind of brands you might connect with as a person in this whole influencer social media times when people do commercial works as their, as themselves.
Yeah, I think that there are styles and I think that there are reputations. I don't like to think of myself as a brand. And as such, when I first started Design Matters, it took me 5 or 6 years to get a logo because I was resistant to seeing that work that was very precious to me commodified as a brand.
Why is that?
Because I didn't want to sully it with with any kind of professional taint. I wanted it to just be this effort that I did that was pure and non-branded. But as podcasts grew, then I kind of had to. Mm. At the time, there weren't a lot of brands, or there weren't a lot of podcasts, rather. So it gave me some time to figure out what I even wanted the brand to be. The problem with social media and the way that humans are using social media now is that we construct our personalities for social media. And it's very hard to be real. We project an image that we would like the world to see. I don't think I've ever put a photograph of myself up on social media when I wake up in the morning and my hair is in that crazy standing up straight position. And, you know, maybe there's some remnants of makeup still on my face that I might have missed when I took it off the night before. Very few people would say that they do that. Why? Because we don't want to be seen that way. And that's still part of who we are. So I think that we project images that we want to be seen as. Very few people use it in a way that is authentic. That's not to say we're inauthentic humans. That's just because we feel that we have to keep up a certain type of image online in our social places. So it's super concerning. I'm super concerned about it for the youth because Generation Z is also nicknamed Generation D, D standing for depressed, because they feel that they have to maintain a certain image. That's part of our DNA. We are wired to want to be the fittest. And so we feel that we need to portray that fittest mentality in every possible way. And it's scary to consider the notion that teenagers are taking down Instagram posts because they don't get the requisite number of likes, because they feel that they're not measuring up, literally not measuring up. You know, why do we need to know how many friends we have? Why do we have to compare that number? Why do we feel better if more people like something that we do? It's human nature, but it's also extremely dangerous for people, especially for people that are not fully formed yet and understanding who they are. So it's concerning to me.
Unfortunately, we need to start wrapping up and we don't want to leave this on this kind of depressed.
Let's talk about something much more positive.
Topic, which is definitely a concerning one. But one last question is about a very signature tune that you have on your show. On the Design Matters, you always start, since 15 years.
15 years I've been using this song.
You play the same tune as your jingle, as your kind of how the whole show starts. And it's the Ghostwriter by the RJD2.
Yes.
Is that correct?
Yes.
Why did you choose that song?
At the time, I was trying to find a theme song. And I asked a person whose musical taste I respected to recommend 3 songs that I could potentially use. And he gave me 3 songs to consider. And this was one of the songs. And I've been using it ever since. It's as simple as that.
And it's a good one.
It is a great song. And I saw on a Wikipedia entry, I think, for the band, that it was listed that that this particular tune was the theme song for Design Matters, and that made me really, 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 really happy.
Thank you so much, Debbie Millman.
And thank you for coming to Helsinki Design Weekly. It's Ida and me, Anni, here every week, as well as a radio show. We also do a newsletter, which is also in English, that can be subscribed to at helsinkidesignweek.com.
Thank you, you both. You are both amazing. Thank you.
You too. And do you know what's the last song?
Can I sing it?
Yhteistyössä mukana Design Museo ja Camp Garden.